1.5 million patients undergo endotracheal intubation annually.
So does hypoxia trump aspiration?
Could the administration of positive pressure ventilation actually help patients and prevent hypoxemia?
I am a profound believer of an RSI checklist.
Is this a clinically significant difference?
When was the last time these patients were fed?
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. I am so excited for this podcast. We have a special guest with us on this podcast, one of my dear friends, close colleagues, Dr. Ken Butler, our airway guru here at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Ken, thanks so much for joining us on CCPEM.
Michael, thank you for the opportunity. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
This is going to be a great and I think somewhat provocative podcast. We are going to go over a recent publication in the New England Journal of Medicine that, quite honestly, Ken, as soon as I read the title, I knew who I would be going to, and that is you.
Ah, you're killing me.
Well, this article that is going to focus our discussion for this month has to deal with really RSI and intubation, that induction period as we are performing laryngoscopy. The lead author on this particular paper is Dr. Casey and colleagues. It's published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It just came out in early 2019 here, so it is very timely. It is titled Bag Mask Ventilation During Tracheal Intubation of Critically Ill Adults. So let me hit the highlights, Ken, of this article. And no surprise to you, over 1.5 million patients here in the U.S. undergo endotracheal intubation annually. And when we're talking about intubations in the intensive care unit, a fairly high number are actually complicated by hypoxemia, up to 40% quoted by the study authors. And as you and I know, as all of our listeners know, hypoxemia into endotracheal intubation into RSI certainly is a risk factor for peri-intubation, cardiac arrest, and increased morbidity and mortality. Now, when we are administering rapid sequence intubation, there is inherently a delay between the time that we push medications and then we go right to laryngoscopy. And the question that arises during that period, that 45 to 90 seconds, that interval between RSI med administration and laryngoscopy, could the administration of positive pressure ventilation actually help patients and prevent hypoxemia? So that was really the objective of this latest study, was to determine the effect of bag mask ventilation on hypoxemia during tracheal intubation of critically ill adults. This was a multi-center, parallel group, unblinded, pragmatic, randomized trial that compared bag mask ventilation to no ventilation during the interval between induction and laryngoscopy in critically ill adults. It was performed at 7 academic ICUs across the U.S., and they enrolled or included adults above the age of 18 years who underwent induction and tracheal intubation, importantly, in the intensive care unit. They did not include pregnant patients, incarcerated patients, or those that frankly needed immediate intubation that really didn't allow for time of randomization. So what did they do? They randomized patients in a 1-to-1 ratio to bag mask ventilation or no ventilation. So what was the BMV group? Well, bag mask ventilation was provided by the treating clinician during that interval from RSI medication administration to the initiation of laryngoscopy. On that bag valve mask, there was a PEEP valve that was set to deliver anywhere between 5 to 10 centimeters of water. They also had an oropharyngeal airway. They used a two-handed seal and a head tilt chin lift maneuver. They ventilated patients at 10 breaths per minute, and they aimed to deliver the smallest tidal volume that was required to generate a visible chest rise. Now, on the other side, the no ventilation group, bag mask ventilation was not permitted between induction and laryngoscopy, with the exception of patients who failed the initial attempt and or they needed to be treated for dangerous levels of hypoxemia, so when saturations fell below 90%. Importantly, all methods of pre-oxygenation were allowed in either group before induction, and they also, while they didn't mandate, they did provide for the ability for apneic oxygenation. What was their primary outcome? It was the lowest oxygen saturation observed during the interval between induction and 2 minutes following tracheal intubation. A secondary outcome was just singular, and that was the incidence of severe hypoxemia, where the pulse oximetry reading fell below 80%. And then they also had some safety and procedural outcomes. So what were the results of the study? Overall, they included 401 patients. About half of them were being intubated or in the ICU for sepsis or septic shock, and about 60% of them had hypoxemic respiratory failure as the reason they were being intubated. 199 got assigned to bag mask ventilation, 202 to the no ventilation group. Overall, that primary outcome, the median lowest SpO2 or pulse oximetry reading in the bag mask ventilation group, 96%, and in the no ventilation group, 93%. In fact, the mean difference between the lowest pulse oximetry reading between the two groups was about 4.7%. In terms of their secondary outcome, the incidence of severe hypoxemia, so pulse oximetry readings less than 80%, it was essentially 11% in the bag mask ventilation group and 23% in the no ventilation group. Additional outcomes that the authors reported, there was a lower percent of patients in the bag mask ventilation group that had pulse oximetry readings that fell below 90%. And overall, there was no difference regarding the incidence of operator reported aspiration or the presence of new opacities on chest X-ray seen within 48 hours after intubation. Now, importantly, the study wasn't blinded. There was a few other things about this study in terms of limitations that, Ken, I'm really now going to turn this over to you in terms of a critical analysis. And really, does this change practice for patients we're intubating in the emergency department? Should we really be considering performing bag mask ventilation between our induction time and the time that we go to perform laryngoscopy? So, Ken, our airway guru, our airway expert, what do you think about this latest study?
Well, first thing I want to say, I want to commend Casey that put this study together because it really sheds light on the subject, and I commend anybody that publishes any airway article, whether we have concerns or reservations about the data or not. So my thought is, let's just start from the beginning. If I was going to conduct a study in the ICU that looked at the first or one leg, if you will, of this, of aspiration, when was the last time these patients were fed? And the reason why I start with that, the ER patients to me are an unknown. Most of the patients in the unit are known. They have known disease, known times of feeding, whether it's oral or gastric or parental or what have you. So they know their cardiac and pulmonary status. I would have kind of liked to know that prior to this study being done because there may have been time in the unit to get that data on these patients. So that's big piece of the puzzle to me in reference to its aspiration. But let's come back to the hypoxia piece of it. The most important thing was they were not standardized on their pre-oxygenation across the board. Some patients got high flow, some didn't, some got nasal pronging. Some patients even had CPAP or BiPAP prior to induction of RSI meds in both arms. So we look at that and we're saying, well, if they were bagged prior to this, then you recruited a VLI and opened up FRC. So maybe that would have hindered some of your results because as we know in the emergency department, we may not have time to do that. Again, I would use the ICU patients for what you can and get more of a controlled study out of that. The things that I look at this that to me are important are this. I think emergency medicine has done wonderful about intubations, and across the board, we tend to be more successful as every generation graduates in residency. So number one, I'm going to start with this. I am a profound believer of an RSI checklist, and it does have to do with this paper. If you're intubating out there for your listeners and not using an RSI checklist, I guarantee it will help you, and you will find us something or a mistake that you made in this peri-intubation period. And why I bring that to light, please, the RSI checklist does talk about positioning patients. So my question number one, could you have sat these patients up in a 30-degree angle? We know from critical care data that decreased the risk of aspiration and decreases hypoxia. That came out of their thoughts. My point is that could these patients have been seated up or reverse Chandelenburg? Two, the RSI checklist that we use here at Maryland, we kind of ultrasound everybody to get a look at what their cardiac and pulmonary status is, which guides us to some degree when we make them chemically apneic, their reserve. It's all about cardiac and pulmonary reserve. I would have liked to seen that just again, these are ICU patients. They're not crashing per se, and you have more time to construct data, which I think that this paper shows, but not to the point that it's really going to change our management. I want to know more about standardization. all patients that we do, regardless whether they have pulmonary disease or no pulmonary disease, still get high flow nasal cannula, seated upright, and our adjuncts to airway management are always there. Again, the RSI checklist makes you, if you will, do that before you ever push the induction agent or paralytic and prior to putting them down, I quote. And that's key. As I review this paper, yes, we're going to bag patients that are hypoxic. We've all known that from the get-go. But I have to say this, please, and maybe it's because I'm in the ED and not in the ICU. Vomit is the enemy. I think my colleagues have made that statement before I ever did. And if you've intubated somebody and during RSI they vomit for whatever reason, it hinders everything. It causes hypoxia, hinders your view. So we have to weigh out at the end of the day what trumps the equation. Maybe not a bad word to use today for some people, maybe a good word. I'm going to stay out of that. So does hypoxia trump aspiration? I personally think it does, and I have to approach the patients like this. But again, the patients that we see here in the ED that have higher risk of bringing up beer, blood, and buffalo wings, I'm always concerned about that, hence ramping them up, increasing the position or angle of the bed, and of course, giving high flow nasal cannula. So the paper doesn't really say that to me because I want to know the fed state patients in the aspiration risk, and I want to know patients that have known pulmonary disease or hypoxia in prior to the patients that are not getting bagged. And maybe that would change my management.
Outstanding, Ken. Thanks so much for that critical analysis. Now, let's just go off the script here in terms of asking you additional questions. If we needed to perform bag mask ventilation, what are your pearls and potentially pitfalls around this type of scenario, especially for patients we're intubating in the emergency department?
So if we could just freeze time when you and I are talking, Mike, as soon as I have induction enough, I put in a nasal trumpet because I would never religiously bag anyone without a nasal trumpet. And I think that that saves us. Two, do we have the proper size mask on? Do we have a tight seal? Do we have a peep valve on it, again, to open up more alveoli? But we know now that sitting patients up really does help us out, right? Gravity is our friend when we do this. Again, we've taken the dogma of laying people flat in the OR, which is so right in a controlled environment and pre-assessed, to the patients that have the risk of hypoxia and aspiration to the ER. And that really does help us out a lot. And again, you can still leave the nasal cannula on while you're bagging if you needed to. I don't ever cut that off. And I unfortunately still see respiratory techs that like to do that. So we have the high flow nasal cannula up all the way. The bag is hooked up appropriately. And again, that checklist always makes sure that my oxygen ports are independent of the device it's using and connected, that we're not bagging on room air or in transfer from EMS to the wall units in the ED, and then bag them gently and appropriately during this induction phase and during this chemical apneic phase. But again, we need to be careful because, as you know, Mike, we see more and more patients with right ventricular diseases such as profound pulmonary hypertension. So I have to be questionable about who I'm going to bag and drop their blood pressure. And that always comes into play.
That's great. And I will have to admit to you that in the course of the past year, I've committed one of those errors in that bagging a patient, their pulse oximetry readings not increasing, finally turn around to see that the BMV is not connected to oxygen, and really emphasizing the importance of what you just mentioned on the checklist. Yes, we know that there have been some studies this past year in 2018 about RSI checklists. Notwithstanding, you and I have certainly reviewed enough cases to where we think it is markedly, markedly beneficial.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Now, in terms of getting patients up to a certain pulse oximetry reading, do you have kind of a critical threshold where you will continue to perform other measures such as BMV to get them to that threshold before you actually perform laryngoscopy?
There's a nice, I believe it was Annals that put this out a while back, that stated that if you are on high flow nasal cannula and 100% non-rebreather, not bagging, obviously, and your SAT was only 93%, your risk of hypoxia during apnea was high. So that's kind of my barometer number. That 93% SAT isn't a good place to be if you're on high flow nasal cannula and a non-rebreather. So that tells me I'm probably going to need to bag the patient if I'm just looking at a number. Now, we know from hematology that where we fall on that hemoglobin saturation curve is anywhere and above. But for EM, when we're not getting ABGs, studies on patients prior to this, that kind of gives me some idea that the patient is not going to do well and they're going to crash. So that patient, I'm more thoughtful about gently bagging the minute I start apnea because I don't have any cardiac or pulmonary reserve on that patient.
Yeah, I think that's really, really helpful. And circling back to this particular recent article, the results, as I indicated, the lowest pulse oximetry reading was 96% in the bag group versus 93%. You know, their primary outcome didn't necessarily march out to be a patient-centered outcome. And, you know, my question maybe to you then, thinking about that critical threshold, is this a clinically significant difference, the 96 versus 93%?
It's not, Mike, because we know that. I think your listeners would say, well, what did we get out of this? It's almost a wash, per se, in that percentage number. It doesn't tell me that much. Again, risk below that, we all know that we would bag somebody up that continued to get hypoxic. It doesn't tell me anything, per se. And again, does hypoxia in that case trumps aspiration? Well, it has to, because we have to deliver the tube. It's unfortunate if someone gets an aspiration pneumonia secondary, but aspiration pneumonias on a ventilator are better than someone who's vomited in front of you and you can't get the tube.
So we've talked about a huge number of pearls, and I can't thank you enough, Ken, for really looking at this article and then having this conversation. Certainly, we are bringing you up to speed with the latest literature that has just been published in the last month. It is an important article. Take a look at it. Do a deeper dive and analysis on your own. Some things that I'm taking away, I think, Ken, from this podcast, certainly an RSI checklist, definitely beneficial. Patient positioning, especially during the pre-oxygenation period. The utilization, I know that you're a big fan of apneic oxygenation and perhaps also non-invasive ventilation for patients who are hypoxemic. And then if need be, in someone who is hypoxemic, certainly we would perform bag mask ventilation, but ensuring that we're doing it correctly, the right seal, it's connected to O2, we have our PEEP valve, and then do you have any other pearls on pre-oxygenation?
No, it was just that you thought that you prepared to think it through, not just say, well, I'm only going to do it if the patient gets hypoxic. Do you have everything in line? And again, your equipment, Mike, and that's always the right answer versus somebody fumbling and missing whatever. The connector pops off the bag, what have you. Again, RSI becomes difficult because it's not just a mindset, but it's also a procedure, and procedures have risk of equipment failure. And that really is the answer to that.
Well, I can't thank you enough for coming back on the podcast. It's been way too long, Ken, since we've had you on for these discussions. So my thanks, certainly thanks on behalf of our listeners for joining us here.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Once again, Mike Winters for CCPEM from the University of Maryland School of Medicine. As you all are now viewing, we have our new and updated website. So please shoot us some feedback on how interactive it is. We think it provides you with a much better experience in terms of listening to the podcast. Some exciting things yet to come here in 2019. Once again, thanks to Ken Butler for joining us on this very special podcast to review some hot off the press articles related to rapid sequence intubation. Thanks for listening to this podcast. We will talk to you on the next one. Bye for now.